Diablo 4 arrives on June 6th. As the forces of hell gather, only you can stand in their way. Journey across the expansive open world of Sanctuary. Choose from 5 powerful classes to fit your playstyle. Adventure with your friends in 4-player co-op with cross-play and cross-progression on all platforms on June 6th. Hell welcomes all. Pre-purchase now at Diablo4.blizzard.com. Rated M for mature. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by KPMG. At KPMG, innovation is the go-to state of mind. Their visionary thinkers and advanced technology help you see beyond the now, uncover new insights, and turn them into opportunities. KPMG can help you leverage the value of data and drive transformational outcomes through innovation. To explore their thinking, go to kpmg.us.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back. It's always great to have Ian Bremmer on, the president of Eurasia Group and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Power of Crisis. Ian, welcome.
Hey, good to be with you, Brian.
Hey, Ian, before we go any further, let's talk about what's happening in Ukraine. We understand another hypersonic missile was knocked down by a Patriot. And when I asked Admiral Stravitis that last week, he said basically we got lucky. What's going on here?
There was a question of whether the hypersonic missiles are actually being launched at hypersonic speed or just have that capability. I've seen the military, U.S. military analysts asking that question. Obviously, it's great that we have the Patriots stood up in Ukraine. They have been able to contest the skies and inbound. We've seen a lot of missiles getting knocked down that otherwise would be hitting Kiev and civilian infrastructure. And so, I mean, Ukrainians are alive today that wouldn't be because of the defenses that are being stood up by the United States and allies. It's a really big deal. And I'm personally gratified that we're doing it.
What about the long range missiles the UK are given?
So it's interesting. I've had conversations in the United States recently that the view in the Biden administration is that Putin's red lines are not on what he'll do if the U.S. And allies provide military equipment are not to be taken seriously. In other words, there's much less concern that if we are giving advanced missile systems, tank systems, advanced aircraft. We're not gonna hold back on that because we're scared that Putin is going to take some kind of escalatory measures against NATO. And that was not the view, say, 6 months ago. So in part, it's the gloves coming off. In part, it's the boiling frog. You get used to the temperature going up, and then you do the next thing, and then you do the next thing. But the Ukrainian government and the president himself have also privately guaranteed the Brits that they would not be using these new missiles to target inside
Moscow,
Russian territory itself. In other words, Crimea, sure. Occupied Ukrainian territory, yes. Russian equipment in all those places, yes. But not going after centers in Russia, which, you know, is something that the Brits had been and have been concerned about.
Does that mean ATACMS, American ATACMS, longer range missiles could be next to go past HIMARS?
I think so. But I know that part of the problem with the ATACMS, Brian, is the feeling that the Americans actually didn't have suitable numbers to start sending them over. So I can tell you that the Americans were perfectly comfortable with the UK system being sent to Ukraine, that was discussed before the decision was made. And I expect that if it's considered that there isn't a problem just in the production lines, I fully expect that the Americans will also provide.
That'll be interesting. How NATO can't lose here. And there's just no way they can't lose. The ramifications would be catastrophic. Don't you agree?
I think what's clear is that the Russians can't win. If you ask me, I mean, the definition of winning and losing is so critical here. So I don't see a scenario in the near future, in the foreseeable future, where the Ukrainians get back all of the land that has been illegally taken by Russia, not just since February 24th, but since 1994. Since 2014. I don't believe that that's likely to happen. But I think that Ukraine is going to get massive funds to reconstruct its country post-war. I think that Ukraine will get security guarantees from NATO allies, a la what Japan gets or Israel gets, that will help ensure that Russia will not get a second bite at that apple. I think that sanctions against Russia will stay very high, and they will be economically punished for what they've done. I think some of Russian assets will be seized and that have been frozen before and will be used for reconstruction. And I also think that Ukraine will be brought into the European Union. So if you add all of that up with the courageousness of the Ukrainians fighting against Russia for the last 14, 15 months now, that to me doesn't feel like NATO is losing. That feels like Russia's losing, and that feels like Ukraine is, you know, getting back on its feet again. And,
but Ian, but right now, as of this moment, they have 17% of the Ukrainian land. I mean, the Ukrainians are about to go on a counteroffensive. Yep. What is tolerable?
Look, none of this is tolerable. I mean, 8 million refugees is not tolerable. Tens of thousands of war crimes, not tolerable. The 40,000 Ukrainian civilians dead, is that tolerable, Brian? I think you and I would say that's not tolerable, and yet the Ukrainians have had to deal with it. I do believe that the Ukrainian counteroffensive will lead to some significant land being retaken. There are right now three different defensive lines that have been set up by the Russians, dug in Ukrainian territory. And NATO leaders believe that in the counteroffensive, the Ukrainians will be able to break through one or perhaps two of those lines, which will bring them closer to breaking the Russian land bridge to Crimea and will allow them within easy artillery distance to continually threaten that land bridge. And that would put Ukraine in a meaningfully better position if negotiations were to start on the back of that counteroffensive. Is that tolerable? I mean, Brian, you and I are not in a position to say what's tolerable for the Ukrainians. I think we can both admit that.
Right. So the Chinese now, we don't have a problem with the Chinese trying to broker a peace deal. Now, why the Ukrainians would ever agree to peace when they're on the precipice of their counteroffensive, I don't know. Are you comfortable with the U.S. just acquiescing this role?
No, I'm not comfortable with an acquiescence. I am comfortable that if we get to a point where negotiations are going to start, and the Ukrainians need to be on board with that, obviously, since they're the ones whose land we're talking about, then I believe that you're not going to have any negotiation that's effective with the Russians if no one is talking to the Russians. And the Americans are not talking to the Russians. The Germans, the Brits, the Canadians, they're not talking to the Russians. The people that are talking to the Russians are the Turks, the Chinese, the Indians, the United Nations Secretary General. And the Chinese have expressed a willingness both to Putin as well as to Zelensky to play a role. And, you know, when Xi Jinping belatedly phoned up Zelensky after his trip to Moscow on the anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster, they spoke for an hour. And the Ukrainians did not reject the idea of a Chinese role in eventual discussions and eventual negotiations. So I think if the Ukrainians are okay with that, realistically speaking, I think that the United States and NATO need to facilitate it.
Well, they are clearly the influential person country for Russia. But to sit there as the referee, to me, doesn't seem logical.
No, you're right. Look, Brian, they can't be the referee,
yeah,
in the sense that they are not in any way honest brokers. But I mean, the United States isn't an honest broker on Israel-Palestine. But we have historically believed that the United States still plays a critical role in trying to bring those countries together. I would not trust that any peace deal brokered solely by the Chinese would have any possibility of succeeding between Russia and Ukraine. I also believe that the Chinese are likely to have a role to play. And what the difference is between those two very different outcomes, I suspect, is going to be a matter of very significant discussion, including a discussion that has already started between the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, and his counterpart in Vienna, the Chinese, last week.
How do you feel about us getting back into talks with a country that sent a spy balloon over our country, is threatening us for entertaining the Taiwanese president, that is infiltrating into Central and South America like they've been doing? And now when they decide that they don't want our Secretary of State in, it seems like we're begging them to talk. Do you like that stance?
I don't trust them, but I also think that we need to be engaged. I mean, when the Americans and the Soviets in the depth of the Cold War, we were talking regularly. And I don't like the idea that for the last 2.5 years during the pandemic, there was virtually no regular communication between the two largest economies of the world. We don't have to like each other, but we have to engage. And it's not just because we need to work together on climate change for the good of humanity. It's also because we have issues that we need each other for. U.S.-China trade today, Brian, is at its highest levels in history. And that's not because we like China. That's because we get a lot of stuff from the Chinese, and they trade a lot with the United States. It's not no matter what you think, it's not about to go away. So, you know, the idea that, you could be married to somebody, you can really dislike them, you can really distrust them, but if you've got kids, you're going to engage with them, right? And that's kind of the way we are with the Chinese right now.
But how you get in gives you the leverage or not. So now we're engaging. They've refused because they said, well, we don't like talking because when we talk, we don't like the way you're acting. So whatever that means as you in Chinese philosophy. But when you look at what they're doing too, what we're trying to do with our CHIPS Act, they're now trying to become their own provider when it comes to chips. Will they be able to pull it off?
We don't know. I mean, you talk to the leading experts on semiconductors in the United States, and they are of different minds on whether the Chinese will be able to catch up in the some like 2 to 3 generations they are behind with TSMC and America's allies, let's say South Korea, the Netherlands right now. China's way behind. The Americans are belatedly putting big investment into building out that industry in the U.S. And we also need to go beyond that. We need to invest better in STEM education, and we need to invest better in visas for the talent that we need to staff these factories. So you need the ecosystem. You can't just build the plants, because if you have the plants but not, you know, the line for the people that are going to work them, we're going to have problems. And we've ignored this for 20 years.
Lastly,
We've allowed this industry to get hollowed out from the U.S. We did the same thing on semiconductors that the Germans did with gas, and basically gave that national security to Russia. And we're finally addressing it.
And Taiwan. And lastly, how much damage was done in the 45 seconds to the Russia-U.S. relations because of this whole Russia investigation into Trump? Now we find out between the Durham probe and others that there was no there.
Yeah, I was never comfortable with this notion of Russian collusion. I mean, there were people like Trump's old electoral advisor that had close, illegal connections with the Russians, but there was never evidence that Trump personally was involved in that way. And I thought that was made clear by the Mueller report. But belatedly, it is obvious that there were political efforts to drive that conversation, and that was inappropriate. And I'm glad that finally came out.
Yeah, damage was done during that time because no talks were taking place because nobody trusted each other. Ian Bremmer, always great. Thanks so much, Ian.
Take your time.
The Fearless and Proud podcast series looks at acts of bravery and strength by women. And in the first season, we'll look at women who played important roles in the Civil War. In episode 3, we'll be looking at two intriguing women of the war. First, Cuban-born Loretta Janetta Velazquez, who was sent to the United States for an education by her well-to-do Spanish family. We then move on to the legendary Harriet Tubman. We'll discuss her time as a nurse, soldier, and spy for the Union Army, and talk about the Cumbie River Raid, a turning point in the war. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.